Hello and welcome to News Club. I'm your host, Em, and today I'm with Tom Chivers, as per usual. And we have a fantastic guest, Maxine. Thank you for coming to this podcast. Maxine is from New Internationalist. So Maxine, what should be headline news?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to speak to you both. So I really like this question because it reminds me of a segment in one of my favorite podcasts, which is called Canada Land. And it's like a media criticism show in Canada where I'm from. So it kind of gives me a good connection back home while I'm here in the UK. But they have a little segment called Duly Noted, where they always ask guests to sort of duly note a story that isn't making headlines or that isn't in the news enough. So I always learn a lot of interesting stuff from that segment. You know, I feel like probably what you're going for here is a specific story that isn't making headline news. And I think there's so many things that I could mention. And I think something that we definitely pride ourselves on at New Internationalist is being able to tell some of those stories, certainly not all of them, but certainly as many as we can that aren't really making it to headline, you know, mainstream news. But I think actually what I feel like broader than that of what I think should be headline news is the fact that, you know, there's obviously so many coalescing enormous crises and problems that we're facing in the world today. When you look at the climate crisis, the cost of living crisis, the genocide in Gaza and Sudan, the war in Ukraine, and like all of these huge, huge problems that we're facing. But I think what isn't talked about enough in the certainly in the mainstream media, but across a lot of media, is the fact that we can actually solve these problems, or at least most of these problems, very easily. You know, it's obviously easier to fall into the trap of the fact or of fall into the trap that it's unsolvable, that, you know, it's bigger than us. It doesn't matter what we do. You know, it's too much. And I've certainly fallen into that trap myself. I think we all have. But I think that, you know, it's not enough of a story that it doesn't have to be this way, and that this isn't just like an inevitability of humanity and, you know, our existence on this planet. And the reason I say this is because we have a piece coming out in our next issue from the anthropologist Jason Hickel, who I'll also be interviewing for our podcast, which I host and produce, called The World Unspun. And so I was working with him on that piece and my colleague Amy, and he explains that, you know, we know exactly, we as the people know exactly what we need to do to solve these problems, and we have enough labor, factories, and resources to do it. But he explains that the problem is that we don't have control over production, and capital does. So he goes on to explain what a post-capitalist world would look like and how we get there by thinking differently about taxes and maximum income and things like that. I'm not going to try to reiterate his whole argument, and he'll, you know, put it much more eloquently and convincingly than I can. But I just think that this is such an important story that we're not being told enough, is that, yes, things are so bad right now. Things are like incredibly horrible, but that they don't have to be, and that we have tools at our disposal to fix them. And, you know, I just wish our media was better at giving people that context and giving people the tools and information to be able to change it, that we're not just going down this road of horror with no options. So people can and should save themselves, and here's how to do it. That's what I wish we saw splashed all over the news every day, but unfortunately we don't.
Absolutely. And I do think that fits and ties in perfectly to what we're trying to do here as well with News Clubs, which is talk about news and what to do about it, right? Really emphasizing that, like, this, again, this hopelessness that you're alluding to is felt when nothing is being done. And I think to really engage with ideas and also then actions that lead towards creating new worlds, not only do they give us hope, but they give us something to actually practically engage with, and therefore feel alleviated of that kind of like existential dread that is held over us like a very, very shitty gray cloud.
Yeah.
Tom, would be lovely to hear your voice. Do you find yourself with that cloud?
Yeah, like everybody else. But I think, as Maxine was saying, I think what's so encouraging is that we do have, like, because of the independent media movement that has been building up, because of the collaboration between independent media, civil society groups, magazines, journalists, charities, you know, all these different movements in these spaces, because there's so much more communication, we are, as a kind of a movement, much more aware of the positive things that can be done in response to all of these crises. And I think maybe, because it's obviously an institutional failure of so much of the corporate media, and particularly commercially led media, that they don't see in their kind of journalistic values that there is newsworthiness in solutions, right? There's newsworthiness in scandal and collapse and things going wrong, but they will find excuses to say why it's not exciting or interesting to talk about the things that could be done about these crises. And I think in some ways it's kind of a failure of some people in our movement that if you ever have these opportunities to go onto these platforms and talk to journalists or broadcasters, and they say, well, won't that just be too expensive, or that's all pie in the sky? I think what we need to do more as a movement is say, well, what the fuck are we doing now instead? Like, clearly the status quo of the way we're trying to do things isn't working. It's making things worse. This kind of antipathy to action, I think, is something that we as a movement are particularly well placed to fight against, as well as calling for the solutions to the climate crisis, more justice for migrants and marginalized groups, you know, fighting racism and all the things that we're like, we get enthusiastic about wanting to do, talking about the solutions to them and also just talking about, like, you know, the fact that there are solutions in place and there are things we can do, and rebutting and rebuking and attacking this idea that things have to stay the way it is now, like trying to do something different isn't possible. I think that's something that's got to be more core to the way we try and engage, you know, not just like using media tactic, because not everybody has the opportunity to go on these large platforms, but talking in general with like your neighbors and friends and as part of your campaigns is showing that we are excited about these solutions, and that, you know, not falling into that trap of, you know, the gray cloud trap of just, you know, things are really bad and we've got to do something, actually then say, and here's something we could do, here are these solutions we have. So yeah, it's definitely something that needs to be in the move, in the news more, and we have the solutions to hand, so let's celebrate them.
Absolutely, and I look forward to hearing that podcast. I think it's rare that we get someone to give those kind of, as you say, post-capitalist insights. But anyways, to speak more on New Internationalist and your work itself, I'd love to start with you and like what brings you to that space. So who inspires you and why to begin with? What specifically about New Internationalist, about news, has really made you want to be in this space?
Yeah, no, I mean, I wanted to be a journalist for a long time. And I did my bachelor's in journalism back in Canada. And I think I had this sort of black and white vision of, I want to be a foreign correspondent. I want to travel around the world, report on exciting things that are happening and like have all these stories and, you know, be in the news. And I think like it wasn't like a self-serving interest at that point, but it was just maybe a bit of a naive kind of desire to just travel around the world and see how things are. And I still definitely feel that way. And I still am so excited and interested in the world. But I think I did my bachelor's and then I did work in international development. I worked in Ghana and Nepal for a couple of years. And then I moved to London to do my master's in media and development. And I feel like that master's program in particular, I mean, when you're fresh out of your undergrad studying journalism and you have this opportunity to go to Africa and you kind of, you know, can see all of these different places and how different the world is from growing up in the West, you were definitely presented with this sort of, you know, vision of what development is, so to speak. And I think when I came to SOAS to do that master's, I think I had it in my head of like, this is going to be a degree to sort of teach me how to be a journalist reporting on international development or like communicate around the, you know, global South, so-called developing world. And in some ways it was that, but it also was definitely not that. And I think it was more than anything a really important criticism of, you know, why so much of the world is so impoverished and deprived and like why they have so many floods and catastrophes, and that, you know, we're not just the benevolent West going over to give handouts, and that it's because, you know, we're such good people. And that degree, honestly, I mean, it was a COVID degree, but it just completely opened up my mind and like totally like shook up everything that I thought I knew at that point. And I read so many amazing things. I had like amazing professors and was just presented with so many different like points of view and cultures and just, yeah, ways of thinking about the world. And I came out of it so critical. And I felt like I didn't know any of the answers. But I think that was kind of the point, is that you didn't go to the degree to just be like, you know, here's all the answers of how to do things, but you actually come out of it being like, everything is actually wrong and we need to fix this and we need to find the solutions. So then I, during that degree, became really interested in Western Sahara, which is a territory that I'd literally never even heard of. I saw a headline that was war returns to Africa's last colony. And I was like, what's Africa's last colony? I've never heard of this before. It was just like a New York Times tweet. And then I clicked on it, and it's this region south of Morocco that was a former Spanish colony that Morocco invaded in 1975 and has been occupying ever since. And the Sahrawi indigenous people have been waiting for, you know, their independence and their rights. Hundreds of thousands live as refugees in the Algerian desert. And I just went down this complete rabbit hole of these people and this territory that I knew absolutely nothing about and became so interested in it. And, you know, wrote a couple stories about it for the SOAS Spirit student newspaper and did some freelance pieces on it. Met loads of people, well, not loads, because not many people know about it or were interested in it, but you know, made some contacts who were academics or activists in the UK that did know about it, ended up working for a charity that did work in the refugee camps in Algeria, went to Algeria, met more people, and it just sort of blossomed from there. And that, I think, issue of Western Sahara and the Sahrawi people just encompasses so much of what is wrong with our world and like what, you know, who wins out and who loses. And when this job came up at New Internationalist, I was looking back at some of their past coverage. And even the first story on the homepage was actually a piece about climate capitalism. And they made reference to Morocco using Western Sahara's land and resources for the so-called Green Revolution. And I was like, I can't believe this magazine is covering this. I've literally never seen like any media properly give this the attention that it deserves. And I was like, right, this is where I want to work. Like, this is it. Like, these are the kind of perspectives that we need more of. And ever since then, it's really kind of reinforced that, is that not only am I learning about places that, you know, it's not just this big idea of like war in Africa, but like there's so much nuance and there's so much complexity and there's so many reasons behind why things are the way they are. And I feel like New Internationalist and our contributors and, you know, my co-editors have just played such an important role in shaping my thinking around that and shaping my passion for helping other people understand that. And so that's why I keep doing it, is because I genuinely care so much about it, and I want other people to care about it too. And I want to like help tell stories in a way that other people can get as excited and passionate as I felt like I did when I first started learning about this particular issue, but, you know, also on a daily basis, other issues that are pitched to me and that we cover in the magazine and the website. So I know that's kind of long-winded, but that's sort of, yeah, how I ended up where I am.
That's a brilliant story. Thank you so much. Would you say that during that period, prior to working with New Internationalist, there was an idea or something that just spoke to you like crazy? Or was it just like holistically the experience on the whole?
I think it was a bit of both. Like, I mean, there were certainly some readings. There was this one reading, I remember, it was about this concept of like the ideal refugee and the Sahrawis as the so-called ideal refugee, in that, you know, something that is acceptable to the West, that the West would want to support, and that, you know, that's not too disruptive, that, you know, is quite passive. No, they're just these people who are just struggling a little bit, and, you know, we could just help them, and we just need to put some money in them, and then they'll hush up and go away. And that's the cause that the West is like most likely to get behind. And it was just really unpacking like what that means and looks like, and how it's not that these refugees are creating that narrative for themselves, obviously, but that's what's kind of imposed upon them, which was true to an extent for a while with the Sahrawis, but then they've also just been, you know, long forgotten, and, you know, nobody's really doing anything to help them anymore. And it's like, it's just really sad the way they've been forgotten. But I think also holistically, it was just piecing different things together of like, you know, these people didn't just happen to end up in the desert. Like, they didn't just choose to leave their homeland and set up these like camps where they have no access to like food and resources and jobs and things. That everything happened for a reason, and that, you know, it's not, there's all these other sort of political dynamics at play in terms of who wants to keep them there and who wants to bring them back. And like, at the end of the day, the people, I think what really, maybe to start over with that answer, I think what really hit home for me was actually when I went to the camps in person for the first time. I've been twice. And when you go, having, you know, been a student and a freelance reporter from the UK, well, reporting on this from the UK, it's so different to then actually go there on the ground and meet the people and see the reality that they're living. I met a few women in particular who spoke amazing English and who I've remained good friends with, and were able to like really communicate well in English, which is just so helpful for, yeah, just understanding and understanding each other and their cause. And I think that interaction, I was obviously so lucky to be able to go in person, but to just feel like they were so excited and so eager to tell their stories when people don't come that often and people, you know, just sort of ignore them. So I think that was when it all sort of clicked together, is that it's one thing to write about this from an academic point of view, you know, for my dissertation, or to report on it from a newsy angle, you know, from my desk at my house in London, but then to actually like be there and speak to people and see the reality of what they're living through brought everything together for me, I guess, and just like reinforced why I cared about that cause so much in particular. So yeah, it was a bit of both. It was like a few sort of odd readings here and there that just sort of switched on a light bulb, but then also just the experience of like having it all come together in the camps, meeting people and hearing them just tell me directly what they wanted to tell me.
Absolutely. And we speak about that all the time with this idea of actually just being in a room with people, being in a place with people, sharing space with people, sharing food with people, and how integral that is to our lives, our work and everything, and how we want to carry that as a thread through everything that we do. I think really, thank you for sharing that. That's really beautiful. And I think you've already said that New Internationalist Magazine is different from other independent media, and that it is highlighting these kind of stories and is doing this kind of work that's more intentional, that's investigating ideas, as you say, that you actually find interesting. So generally speaking, what does New Internationalist tell us about the world?
I think what I have noticed in really just over the last year and a half that I've worked there, reading all of our back issues, you know, constantly digging through our archive, but also, you know, commissioning and writing new stories, is building this link between struggles and link between movements, and not just covering something as an isolated incident that, you know, if there's a workers' movement uprising in Kenya, there are links back to what's happening in the UK or to what's happening in South America. And being able to sort of piece all those things together, I think, creates this really great sort of feeling of we're not alone in this world and we're not alone in our struggles. So especially during COVID, when we got this feedback from our readers that, you know, you can pick up a copy and dive into the world and just see how people are coming together, celebrating each other, overcoming challenges. And that, you know, we're not just trying to sort of report on an issue, but we're actually trying to give people the context and the facts and the information to A, make up their own minds about, you know, what they think about the issue, and B, have the tools to be able to do something about it, to change it. So, you know, we're a campaigning magazine. So we campaign for different causes and different issues, and we have an action and info section within the big story of every issue. And, you know, that's trusted sort of organizations or movements to follow, or, you know, and ways to get involved with issues. And I think this is definitely something that we're trying to build upon in the news clubs, which I think we'll talk about later. I think, you know, this idea of connecting people across borders, you know, showing how we're not so different from one another, that we face similar challenges, you know, even though they might look different on the ground. At the end of the day, you know, people want to be able to feed their families, have a roof over their head, you know, have decent work, have decent healthcare, and that the means to achieve those things might look different in different contexts and countries, but that there's so much that we can learn from each other. And I think if someone's able to pick up a copy of NI and read a story from any country and be able to find some sort of resonance with themselves and their own lives, or some sort of link to what they're doing, then I think that just proves that we're doing something right and that we should continue building on that. And fortunately, we do quite often hear that people do feel that way when they read our coverage. So I feel quite proud to work for an independent media outlet that does that. And I think we can always do more. But I think that's sort of our main ethos when we put together an issue, is that we want people to be able to find themselves in it in one way or another.
It reminds me actually of the last episode, whereby basically in greater community media based in Govan Hill, they'll have a story about why the bins aren't getting taken out, and also a story about the Romani people. These just being stories of their neighbours, and also stories relating to how they just need to live and what their community is facing. Yeah, like you say, that connectivity, recognising that these are not things that we just get to silo and tell about, but like how it forms part of like a wider narrative that we ourselves form part of, as like almost, you know, as disseminators of information, right? Like, I think it's really interesting to be able to kind of understand how that role is not something perhaps always exclusive to journalists either. And really the role is about highlighting what we already tell ourselves, the stories that we already tell ourselves. I think that's really gorgeous. Tom, I've seen you nod just nonstop this whole time.
I have been nodding nonstop. No, it's been great to hear from Maxine. I mean, first of all, shout out to SOAS and the staff and lecturers at SOAS and the handful of universities like SOAS that offer these kinds of courses that are actually aimed at encouraging a radical mindset, recognizing the sort of global interconnectedness of so many issues, and not trying to pigeonhole them into just like a program on climate change or a program on international development, but recognizing these are interlinked, these are related to all different systems of power. And in particular, solidarity with the staff and lecturers at universities like SOAS, who have been under brutal attack from government cuts in recent years. So many of these programs are disappearing almost as a result of kind of direct government attempts to close down programs that teach this kind of mindset and this perspective. On what New Internationalist does, it's so impressive. And I think what it sort of highlights in so many other, what you might call kind of mainstream reporting on global issues or international development or conflicts or crises that are going on around the world, how much of that is sort of seeped in an imperial bias in the sense of, exactly as Maxine, you've just said, like dipping in and out of these crises, or just like reporting on it once and then saying, well, we've reported on this crisis overseas. It's very difficult. And here's an interview with someone struggling, and maybe we'll come back in 5 years and see how things have gone. And typically things have got much worse. And that's like, you know, where that kind of the newspaper could have taken a much more kind of, you know, concerted stand and reporting on this and trying to bring it to public attention. It's sort of stuck in that paternalist patrician mindset of how a lot of international development and global policy works in general, which is just, we the West will dip in once in a while, give some money, give some aid, that'll work things out, and then we'll come back and see how things have gone in 5 years. But actually, what New Internationalist does in building those relationships, building those connections through reporting, actually helps to build, as you said, global solidarity and understanding in a way that a lot of mainstream journalism doesn't. And I think that's what's so impressive about the magazine, is it's not what you see in a lot of foreign reporting, is that, and particularly, you know, some kind of mainstream or, you know, what you might call boutique outlets on this, they're very niche. They treat it as a niche issue. It's like, oh, you will only be interested in this if you work in international development, or you work for a charity, or you're someone who, you know, lives in different countries and wants to know. And actually, this is like what journalism should be about, right? It's bringing attention to global issues that matter to people and what we can do about them. So I'm sure many of our listeners and newsletter readers are aware of it, but if you're not, go and read it, subscribe, give money, support, get involved.
And on that, like, I think New Internationalist, like the word itself, reminds me a lot of how we oftentimes frame the work that we do locally, which is very much, again, locally centered with the people around us, but with that internationalist understanding and context that really like frames what it is that we're doing, and really recognizing, again, we keep saying this, the connections just across the world, right? Like they really are inseparable. Like our lived realities now, our material realities, and even our spiritual realities, like they are not separate from the history that we've all like collectively experienced and be the outcomes of in one way or another, and just ended up on the other side of this interplay of conflict and of history. But yeah, bringing it back a bit to New Internationalist and yourself, Maxine, it'd be great to do a quick recap then of who are you, what do you do, and why?
Yeah, so I'm Maxine Bettergemose. I'm the digital editor at New Internationalist magazine, and I also host and produce our newly launched podcast series called The World Unspun. I hesitate, not so newly launched. We launched in October, so we're just under a year old. But I am very excited about that show. We release episodes every 2 weeks, and it sort of serves as an extension of the print magazine. So we interview our contributors. We talk more at length about some of the stories that don't make it into the print magazine itself, or that have more to it than can fit within the pages of the print magazine. And the second half was, why do I do it?
So. Yeah, why? Which, I mean, you've alluded to, but just in like a quick, short sentence.
Yeah, I mean, I do it because I just genuinely care and am interested in what's happening around the world. And I want other people to care and feel passionate about it as well. I mean, people will have their own sort of niche interests and, you know, passions. But I think being in a position to commission stories and tell stories myself about what is happening around the world and why it is happening, take lightly, I think, is a really important responsibility and something that I'm really proud to have, with the purpose of building this global solidarity, understanding that the world doesn't have to be the situation that we're in now with all of these global crises doesn't have to be this way, and that there are tools and there are ways to get out of it. So working at New Internationalist and writing, commissioning these stories is all with that kind of mission of bringing people together, building solidarity, helping people understand what's led us to this point, and how we see ourselves out of it. And that those things can often come from surprising places and stories of communities and workers and individuals in different countries around the world. We're all connected. We're all sort of woven in with each other's lives, and that our job as storytellers is to make that clear to people and help people understand why that is the case.
And how do we support that work beyond just subscribing? Like, is there anything else that we can do to say, be part of that, the upholding of New Internationalists?
Yeah, I mean, the subscribing is obviously the main one. Please, you know, subscribe and read us. We've got a print and a digital edition. We've also got our podcasts and our newsletter. But I think, you know, one way to just support this work, and I think support independent media and like continue these conversations more broadly, is, you know, going back to what we were saying about, you know, having a big sort of mainstream Western outlet reporting on a faraway crisis and, you know, interviewing one person that is struggling, like you were saying, Tom, is that, you know, you might read that as a, you know, newsreader who has no understanding or familiarity with that country, and just sort of accept it and be like, okay, well, I guess that's what's happening in Ethiopia right now. Sucks to be there. But then, you know, you would just accept that and leave it and move on with your life. Whereas what I think is so interesting with our storytelling is that we do get challenged on things. People feel very passionately about different things. And I think that comes out more when you draw those links, let's say with climate change in different countries, particularly in the global south, which are just like suffering so massively disproportionately to how we are in the West, is it's because of our consumption here. It's because of our huge, huge consumption of resources. It's not just that they're like more vulnerable to it and, you know, they should just come up with better solutions and that they should just, you know, use less water and, you know, grow more resilient crops. And when you draw those links, you're inevitably going to ruffle some feathers and you're going to, you know, get people thinking. You know, some people will, hopefully a lot of people will agree with our coverage and say, hey, yeah, maybe that's not fair. Like maybe we shouldn't just, you know, claim all these resources for ourselves. And maybe I should change my habits and do things differently or vote differently to make sure that these policies don't continue. But, you know, maybe you'll also ruffle some feathers. And I think if we're pissing off the right, we're doing it right if we're pissing off, you know, the 1%. And if they're starting to pay attention to our coverage and they're trying to do stuff to like change our coverage or like, you know, backpedal on what they said, then that means we're doing something right. And that means that we're getting people talking about it. So I guess, you know, if you aren't yet a subscriber, but, you know, please become one. But if you aren't yet and you do care about these issues generally, I think the best thing you can do is just try to like educate yourself and try to talk about these things with people and, you know, get the conversation moving beyond just accepting this narrative that we're presented with. Like, I think, you know, there's so many issues now that when, you know, when we talk about what should be headline news, like, sure, if you turn on BBC TV at the 6 o'clock news show, you're going to get probably a pretty flat narrative of what's happening around the world. But on the flip side, you know, say what you will about social media. There's so many problems with social media, obviously. But if you go onto Instagram, and someone like me, I get the majority of my news from Instagram these days. Yes, you're being fed a bit of an algorithm, but at the same time, you're getting like a rapid education in like decolonialism and like in what's happening around the world in like 6 Instagram slides. If you're following the right accounts and you're following the right people, you're educating yourself and you're forming your opinions. And I think that is a really exciting time that we're living in terms of how easy it is to get knowledge of everywhere in the world, pretty much, and talk to people about it. So that's the best thing I think we can do just generally as people is like resist this sort of like one-dimensional top-down narrative of like, this is what's happening in the world, accept it, move on. You know, challenge it, read more about it if it's a particular cause that you're interested in, find other sources that are reporting on it, you know, come to our news clubs, come to, you know, other papers' news clubs and talk about it with other people who may agree with you or may disagree with you. But I think that's one of the most important tools at our disposal right now is to, yeah, resist the single narrative, talk to each other and make up our own minds about things.
Couldn't agree more. And funny enough, actually, like I think that links quite nicely to what people can actually bring to their own news clubs, right? Like remembering that we can actually source our information from lots of different places and the fact that I know I learned so much. Like I have this, it's so silly, I have a saved stories reels thing on Instagram and I call it Reel Therapy, like R-E-E-L therapy, because like people will just like say and give you really like fascinating insights and you're like, wow, I didn't even pay for that. That's crazy. But yeah. I think actually on that note, I think it's also worth recognizing that when we do pay for information, which is to say when we do subscribe formally to a publication, we are supporting someone's work. We are facilitating the process of actually being able to gather this information. And I think it's really important to understand that it's out of respect for that work and out of respect for the living of another person that we do so. Because I think we're all very attached to this idea of things being free. And it's like, yes, but also, you know, like be mindful of what it means to also pay for something and also be mindful of what it means to then be able to pay for something and have control over that thing, which yeah. I think links quite nicely to how we talk about mutualization, BBC, all of that. So listen to previous episodes about that because I think it's really interesting. And I'm sure Tom has a lot to say about that, but I'm going to keep you shut up for now because we have time and space to talk about that specifically in a future episode. But yeah. Back to news clubs. What can you tell us about your news clubs? Because you guys have actually went and done this as well. And I'd be really curious to know what you've learned, how that's manifested.
Yeah, it's something that the idea came to us from you guys, obviously. So thank you for that. And we are just starting out. We've done 3 of them so far. We are going to host them once a month, combination of in-person and online events. The first one was with a journalist and contributor on the ground in Kashmir right at the kind of height of the Kashmir crisis when India and Pakistan were lobbing weapons or bombs at each other for a little bit. And it was a pretty tense time. And that was just online with a few of our readers. It was quite small and intimate, but I think that was kind of the vibe that we were trying to create, not like a big webinar where you've got hundreds of people tuning in, but just sort of like you would sit around a coffee shop for a book club. And that first one, even though it was so small, I think it really hit home. One of our readers said, like, this is amazing to just be able to tune in from my desk at home or from my couch at home with a journalist on the ground in this massive, you know, during this massive, you know, world news event, to be able to just tell me directly what's happening, what they're seeing, what people are telling them. And when he said that, I was like, yeah, okay, this is like, we were doing something right here. Like, people are, this is cool, and we should keep doing this. So we did another one, which was online with the co-founder of the Gaza Sunbirds, who we'd done some coverage around. And they had just, the team had just come, Gaza Sunbirds is the Palestinian paracycling team. And they had just come back from Belgium. I think it was the World Championships. I have to go back and check, or like the set below the World Championships. And they'd done really well and, you know, made history as a Palestinian athlete. So we had the co-founder of that team come on board and tell us a bit about that experience, which was also really great. But then for the third one, we were like, we need to do something in person. I think people at the end of the day, you know, nobody wants to join another Zoom meeting, or, you know, it's harder to get people excited about Zoom meetings. So how can we do this in person? People always want to talk about what's happening in Palestine. There's so much to be said on that. There's so much to do around that. So we partnered with Cafe Palestina in Camden, which is just an amazing Palestinian restaurant that has sort of an event space downstairs where they host all sorts of solidarity events. And we had one of our contributors, Hamza Youssef, who had written a piece in our latest magazine, which is about the UN at 80 and the UN's role or sort of lack thereof, the genocide in Gaza today, but also the history leading up to it. And that was such a great event because we had so many more people come. We had like 40 people there. We had some tea and snacks at the back. Hamza and I just chatted a little bit to kind of get some context around the story. We actually had a different speaker before him, who was a man that had come from the West Bank, and he was visiting London as part of this London Palestine Solidarity Group, Camden Abu Dis Friendship Association. So he had done a talk beforehand, and then Hamza and I kind of chatted a bit about his story, and then we kind of opened it up to others. So we always make the events free for new international subscribers and then ticketed for other people. And other people can always put the value of their ticket towards a subscription. So we keep it very affordable, and there's always the opportunity to then, you know, put that towards continued involvement with our work. But what I think was really good about that most recent one is, you know, people were coming up to me after and saying, giving like really constructive feedback about how we could make it better. Like, and how, you know, some people feel a bit intimidated in a big group where it sort of felt like Helms and I were on a panel, and, you know, people don't maybe want to put their hand up in front of that many people and ask a question. But that this always happens, I find. As soon as we sort of formally close the event, then everyone starts talking. And then everyone is like coming up and asking Hamza questions and talking to each other. And it was just really cool to sort of see that come together. And we have our next news club. So kind of building on that momentum, we have our next news club online with a contributor in Ethiopia at the end of July, on July 30th, which he's written a piece in our upcoming, or sorry, in our current issue as well, which is about the simmerings of potentially a new war breaking out in Tigray, which was obviously one of the worst humanitarian crises in the early 2020, like 2020 to 2022. And his name is Samuel Getachew, and he is an amazing, super fearless, incredible journalist who's going to join us to talk about what's happening there. And we've got quite a few tickets for that already. So really excited about that one. Yeah, it's just a really good model, I think, for us. It's quite easy to put together in the sense that, like, so much work goes into the stories and so much work goes into the production that it almost feels like a shame to just sort of put the magazine out. And then, especially for the print stories, we don't have any way really of like gauging how people, you can't see the clicks, you can't see the analytics in the way that you can for like web and social pieces. So it just seemed like a really obvious, although we didn't think of it until you guys came up with the idea, that this is such an obvious way to get people interested in news and talking to each other and get feedback for ourselves, you know, selfishly on our storytelling, but more importantly, you know, bringing people together, helping them understand how they can get involved with issues, take action on progressive causes, meet the journalists, and like build trust, I think, is a really important thing too. You know, there are real people behind these stories. We're not just like AI generating these like newswire stories, but that actually, you know, here's the person who went out into the field and interviewed these people and wrote the story, and now they're sitting at their desk at home telling you more about it. I think that's really cool. I would join that. I, you know, organize them and host them. But even if I didn't, if I saw a news outlet doing that, I'd be like, yeah, that's a great idea. you know, it's a good way to meet people. It's a fun social event, but it's also very informative. So I'm really excited to see where we can take these in terms of doing more in-person events in different cities. We have co-owners at New Internationalists. We have a model where we're owned by our readers, and we have a sort of smaller group of readers who are very involved. They're called our Common Council, and they're got a small group of them who have agreed to host their own news clubs in their respective cities so we can reach people in different time zones, talk about more than just one story. So I think there's a lot of potential. I'm really excited to see where they go. And I just hope people, yeah, keep coming and feel like they can constantly give feedback, because we're not going into this saying, this is the model and this is how we're going to do it. Like it's very much a learning for us in terms of what works best, you know, the format, who we bring on, how we talk about it, and making sure that people who come, if they want to, have the opportunity to talk a lot and talk to each other and talk to us. So yeah, I'm really excited about them. They're very new, but there's lots of exciting stuff to come ahead, I think.
I think that's so cool. It's actually so fun and interesting to hear how they've worked out for you guys. Obviously, it's people who advocate for them. It's very different to hear how they've actually ended up materializing. And I think that's so cool. And as you say, and we often emphasize this, is that for every news club or however you want to host it, right, there's such like a diversity of ways that you can do it. And the fact that you guys are actually bringing on speakers and bringing on people that, as you say, are able to directly tell you about the process of how they went about their work. I think that is cool. And I would also enjoy something like that, right? Like it really makes it so much more personal and interesting. So thank you. Thank you for sharing that. We recently at Binance Festival held a bit of a news club ourselves, I guess, of sorts. So we could start to expose the idea to other people. And if you are interested, this is for our audience, if you are interested in doing so, subscribe to our newsletter and that will bring you to our about page. And you can then see links as well to Media Revolution, who've got a page dedicated a bit more to how we go about that process, any support resources, etc., to making that happen. Finally, up there on their webpage as well, and you can start to see more stuff about Media Revolution, which is quite interesting. But yeah, no, thank you so much for sharing that. I think that's so brilliant, and I hope that more people start to do stuff like that, because like you say, it really is about getting people into a room, building trust, doing things together. Like as you were speaking, it made me think of how there is something to be said about the value of like these publications and the necessity, I guess, that it draws to actually having people in a shared space, something which in lieu of information of analytics, right, you kind of end up doing. But I think it's interesting to also point out the reverse, the fact that like we are able to so quickly get information and data from people online, right? Like there's immediately a disconnection and ability to just be like, right, we've got this information, goodbye. And I think to really acknowledge that, you know what, this is work and this is harder in many ways, but actually the value that we're then like being able to all collectively enjoy is just so much more as people in a room or people on Zoom. And I think seeing more in-person news clubs, I think would be incredible, because I think that's really what we're wanting to see, is like people touch grass and just, you know what I mean, like be able to just be there and start to form like real connections, real intimacy, I think, because that's what I think, yeah, that's oftentimes what we seek, and we can find that in community and friendship and something that is really gorgeous. So yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's really, really brilliant. The final last question. So in 2029, we may live in a Europe and UK that is run by authoritarians. One of our members of the team believes that Farage is going to be elected. So what is the one thing that everyone should do leading up to 2029, Maxine?
Ooh, well, under the assumption that Farage is going to get in, what should we do to prevent that or prepare for that?
I mean, that's part of it. I mean, you don't have to assume that he's going to get elected, but there's a few individuals who are pretty convinced that that's going to be the direction. A lot of party politics at present, yeah.
I mean, people need to read a diversity of news and people need to inform themselves ultimately. I mean, I think this, it's kind of corny, but this idea of like the news diet, I think is actually just a really good way of looking at things. If you're a very leftist, progressive person, you're going to have a certain media diet. But I think there's always some value in at least just understanding what the right is saying about an issue, because it'll help you question your own biases and your own maybe misunderstandings of an issue, even if you completely disagree. And you'll probably read a lot of crap when you go over there, there being the dark side of a lot of right-wing media. But I think it is absolutely crucial to understand how they're reporting on certain issues and be able to kind of piece together why that narrative is getting so much support. It's only going to get worse between now and then with, you know, not just Farage in the UK, but with lots of other right-wing figures and lots of other kind of Western liberal democracies around the world. But I think equally, you know, leftist media needs to do a better job at kind of reaching people who are prone to reading right-wing media. If we're really serious about building this mass movement that can challenge that, we can't just sort of stay within our bubble of like the OG kind of progressive crowd, and we're going to just go to the same rallies and go to the same charities and go to the same schools to bring people on board. We also need to, like, you know, swallow our pride, maybe that's not even the right word, not swallow our pride, but just like make more of an effort to like actually reach the people that we claim to want to be part of our movement. So I think it goes both ways. We, and even, you know, myself, I need to be better at this, is like trying to really actually understand what the other narratives are saying and how they contradict, you know, what we're trying to say, or what the facts are, not even what we're trying to say, what the actual facts are. So we as news consumers have a responsibility to, you know, seek out more diverse information. But where that's not possible, and for a lot of people that's not possible, they don't have the privilege of, you know, time to read loads of think pieces on their commute to work. You know, we as media producers and journalists need to do a better job to make sure that people have the facts and that those facts aren't being skewed towards a narrative which is an easy scapegoating of, you know, migrants and marginalized people. And that's, you know, it all, I think when you're in this space of like leftist media that does this kind of reporting of, you know, the right is scapegoating migrants and marginalized people, it's so obvious and it makes so much sense. And you're like, yeah, of course that's what they're doing. Like, it's so easy to just go to the Daily Mail and see that narrative. But there's still, I think what we forget is there's still so many people that don't realize that. And I think I even see that with like my own friends and my own network, is like, obviously I'm a journalist and I'm in this space all the time. And it's so easy to draw those connections. But then there's some people that I speak to that you can see that they're just maybe coming to realize it and being like, oh, okay, like there's an agenda behind this reporting, or there's, you know, this is, they're interviewing the wrong people to get this story out. So while it may seem really obvious, it's so not obvious for a lot of people, and we need to do a lot of work still, I think, to, yeah, make that more clear, reach more people, tell the facts better, find new ways of telling stories. And in turn, maybe, you know, we'll see Faraj still get in, or we'll see other, you know, similar characters get in. But I think that the odds are greater that people will be more likely to resist that and seek out other options and join, yeah, movements of resistance if they have the facts and the information. So I don't know if that fully answers your question, but that's how I would see it as both a news consumer and, you know, taking responsibility to inform myself of other opinions and other viewpoints, but also on the flip side, doing more to bring in more people into the stories and, you know, into the facts as to why Faraj is going to get in. Because it's not an inevitability that Faraj is going to get in. It seems likely and it doesn't look good. But it's not just like this accepted truth that we're just like, yeah, we're all fucked and like he's going to get in and, you know, the world is going to blow up in 2030. And I think we need to do more to not just accept this inevitability. And that, I think, just all comes back to what I was saying too, of just, you know, not accepting this one way narrative that, you know, capitalism isn't just the way the world works. So it's going to take a lot of work. It's not going to happen overnight, but I think that there is hope.
Absolutely. Would you agree, Tom? Is there hope?
Of course there's hope. Yeah. And I think that there was something Maxine said there about like, we kind of don't have time to wait until 2029 to start saying these things. Because there is there's an element, and it's more like a liberal left media thing than like a left progressive media, but there's this element of like, after certain events have happened, you suddenly get a lot of people who are like, oh, this event sucks, and now I'm suddenly seeing parts of the way the world work and it's changed my perspective on things. And some will turn around and go, well, ha, we told you so. And it's like, we probably didn't tell people that, you know, the real dangers of Trump or what would happen after the Labour government would be elected and obviously go back on all its promises. There's no point waiting until 2029 to tell people, well, you should have seen that Farage was going to be really bad, or you should have seen that there was this rightward march in politics. Actually, that work starts now of seriously engaging with people through both media and activism, and make, you know, not sort of doing the, I'll wait until it happens and then I'll tell you I told you so. It's actually like working collaboratively now to point out that, and also many of these things are already happening, right? That it's not like there will be morning of whatever day it will be in May 2029, Farage will flick a switch where Britain goes from green and pleasant land to horrible fascist island. It's like, no, some of these steps are already happening now under this government, and like thinking that, oh, well, 2029 is the point of no return. No, it's a slow and steady process of ongoing things getting worse, which means that there's more opportunities for us to work and stop it now and not sort of sit back and go, let's wait until then. It's let's work now and use all of our connections and relationships across a movement to, yeah, speak to people who, you know, it may be somebody now who's like relatively supportive of Farage or very fed up with politics and wants things to change, might be there just sort of ready to receive like these kinds of more positive and progressive messages and sort of understand the world in that way. And we can't wait until 2029 for them to go. I didn't see things as they were until now. We shouldn't have waited until after Brexit to tell people they were really stupid. Actually, we should have been engaging with people about where these anxieties about Brexit and globalization came from. Shouldn't have waited until after Labour was elected to like tell them it was going to be really bad and say, I told you so.
Yeah. And I think like, you know, it's just such an unhelpful thing to say, I told you so. Like, who does that serve? And I think that's such something we're very guilty on of the left, very righteous of like, we were right.
Yeah, it's not something that like many of, you know, to talk about our side, but like the people we engage with are not really like that. But actually, we do have to make an effort to go to some of the more liberal minded, particularly like establishment liberal outlets, who will sort of do this woe is me thing when really bad things happen. Like, how did it come to this situation where everyone's really poor and pissed off at the government? It's like, well, we've had, you know, 30 years of horrendous, destructive austerity and neoliberalization, which you didn't seem particularly interested in. So it's partly an element of like working with some of the more major mouthpieces of this and saying, you know, as we were saying at the start, right, there are positive solutions to this stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's no point waiting till events happen to suddenly claim that you knew it was going to happen all along and people should have listened to you. It's like, well, you should have worked harder with us to kind of promote those things and get more people interested and concerned and inspired about alternatives.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Could not agree more. So yeah, that's what you do leading up to 2029. Speak to people normally. Oh my God. Yeah, we also need to like work on our branding and marketing and just generally like having normal conversations. I would like to think that in the realm of news clubs, they're just able to be quite open and quite like welcoming to certain ideas, if that makes any sense, right? Like I think this is kind of something that we also include in our work in terms of how we go about news clubs, which is oftentimes when we come into a conversation, it is the case that certain things, certain ideas will cause that kind of more emotive response. And I think being very mindful of the fact that sometimes we will come into a space with that anger rather than that desire for connection, I think is really, really important. And because it's remembering that like underpinning all of this, right? Even with the person that you hate the most, right? Like, they deserve to live too. Like they deserve a better world too. And calling them stupid isn't going to really help that. And it really is kind of more of a self-serving frustration, I think, oftentimes. And I think saying that can be a little bit frustrating to hear, but I think it's true. Like I'm always going to advocate this idea of like, no one deserves it, right? You know, like the bad guys is the structures, you know, the bad guys is how we collectively almost participate within that, right? And like, it's this kind of like vague, like realm of like obscurity and where nothing is particularly clear and we don't actually come to understand what it means to be accountable or what it means to be like collectively victims of this world, as well as perpetrators of violence in this world, right? Think about the streets that you walk on. Is someone living in the Western world? Who the fuck do you think built those? Who do you think, where do you think that money came from historically, right? Like whether you like it or not, you participate in these systems of violence. And I think being very conscious of the fact that like we are all victims in all of this and therefore we all deserve to kind of collectively band together, talk about these things and really care about one another intimately. Like even if we disagree, even if I find my family at times intolerable, still bloody love them, don't I? And it's that kind of thing of being able to try and see if we can extend that love across the world. But anyways, I'm just sounding like a hippie now. So I'll leave it there. And I just want to thank you, Maxine, so much for coming on. I think it's been really brilliant actually to hear about how news clubs have worked out with you guys as well. And obviously we're going to still be in contact talking and hearing more about what you guys are doing. And I really like wish the best for everything with New International because it's the space that we need, right? And it's brilliant. There are people dedicated to doing this work. Thank you so much, Maxine.
Yeah, no, thank you guys so much. It was really good to speak to you. I feel like it's a good way to fire me up on a Wednesday morning and get back to work.
Absolutely.
So yeah, no, I appreciate you inviting me on. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think we like this recording time. It definitely wakes me up. I'm like, okay, cool. Got it ready for the day. So yeah, thank you, Maxine. Thank you, Tom. And thank you to our listeners. So yeah, check out our newsletter. Check out obviously more episodes from this podcast. Links on our socials, links on our Substack and more on Media Revolution page, which yeah, there'll be more coming from them as well as a hosting space for all this kind of work. So yeah, thank you again and goodbye.